Weimar Germany. Now, did you know this interwar democracy was probably the world's most progressive nation in its day? Think about it. Germany had the world's most prominent gay rights movement. It was home to an active feminist movement that, having just won the right to vote, was moving on to abortion rights. And get this, Jews from Poland and Russia, they were drawn to Germany's tolerance and openness. And yet, this 14-year state-of-the-art democracy became the most tyrannical regime in history, almost overnight.
Deutschland ist heute unser Deutschland. Sie heil!
Weimar Germany soon became Nazi Germany. It's a fascinating story, and my guest tells it well. Benjamin Carter Hett is author of The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power. He's a professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Welcome to the show, Benjamin.
Hi, I'm very happy to be with you.
Now, let's start with February 27, 1933, 9 p.m., the Reichstag in Berlin caught fire. What's the significance of this event?
This comes only 4 weeks into Adolf Hitler's time as Chancellor of Germany. He was still in a politically weak position, and he's in the middle of an election campaign, and suddenly the Reichstag burns down. To this day, there is still argument about who actually did it, but Hitler immediately presented it as a communist coup attempt and used that to push through emergency decrees, which enabled him to crack down, basically gut that progressive constitution you mentioned in your intro, suspend all individual freedoms, and make thousands of arrests of political opponents. So it's really the moment at which he becomes a dictator and not just the leader of a regular coalition government.
So your line then is that the Reichstag fire marked the death of German democracy, right?
If you want to pick one moment where that happens, that's the moment.
Okay, now before he became chancellor in early 33, Ben, Hitler was ridiculed as a non-entity. You make that very clear in your book. How then do you account for his rise to power?
Well, he was underestimated by a lot of people because he came from a humble background. He didn't have a fancy education. In military service in the First World War, he had, in 4 years in combat, never risen above the rank of private first class equivalent in the German army. Lots of elite politicians looked at him only with a kind of scorn. But in fact, Hitler had some really remarkable political talents. He was an extremely compelling speaker. He was very cunning. He had very cool nerves. He had the nerve and the patience to wait for the precise moment to strike and not move too soon. And he was very good at reading his opponents, reading what they wanted. So with all of this, he was actually a much more formidable political adversary than most people thought he was.
Yes, and you argue that a people who crave uncomfortable myths are susceptible to lies and that Hitler lied all the time. And you make the point that the German people heard what they wanted to hear, namely that Hitler would make Germany great again. And yet you say, Ben, that Hitler had nothing but contempt for the German people.
Yeah, it's a strange paradox, but all those things actually go together. Hitler wrote very frankly and bluntly in his famous book, Mein Kampf, about the importance of lies in politics. And in particular, he said, you should tell really, really big lies because people won't be able to get their minds around the fact that you have told such a big lie. And even if the lie is debunked, some residue of it will stay, which is actually something I think we see in political life all the time. What's running along behind that is, you know, anyone who could say that about his electorate is someone who doesn't have a very high opinion of their intelligence, judgment, ability to take on information. So there's always this kind of stream of actually a kind of contempt for the great majority of people that is sort of the flip side of the coin of Hitler's political cunning and tactical cynicism.
And what happened to those who rejected Hitler's version of truth, say liberal Germans? How do they respond?
Well, before Hitler was in power, they tended to respond with contempt and with the confident statement that someone like Hitler, someone so uncultured and crude, could never become leader of a country like Germany, which was the land of poets and thinkers, notoriously. After Hitler's in power, then, of course, it's quite different, because after Hitler's in power, then these people are the targets. The early concentration camps, which he established very soon on taking power, contrary to what you might assume, originally the camps were not full of Jews. They were full of communists. They were full of intellectuals. They were full of artists, lawyers, liberals, ministers, and priests. These people who tended to be the people who had only contempt for Hitler, but who hadn't thought he might ever come to power.
What about the conservative Germans who reluctantly joined forces with Hitler's National Socialist Party in the early to mid-1930s? I mean, how do they respond when it was clear that Hitler was bent on creating a totalitarian dictatorship?
Well, that's another really interesting story, and one which I think people in a lot of countries today, including the one I live in, might feel there are some echoes. There was in Germany, as everywhere, a conservative establishment which had particular goals. The military wanted to increase the size of the army. Big business wanted to reduce union power and regulation. But they knew they couldn't get enough votes for those policies to actually carry them into practice. But Hitler was a proven vote getter. And the conservative establishment generally didn't like him. They thought he was crude and vulgar and so on. And they thought he might be a little dangerous and a little radical. But on the other hand, he might be able to put together an electoral coalition that would be something they could use. And they could sort of use him as a tool to get their own agenda through. And so they were willing to use him and make a kind of Faustian pact. And then bit by bit, after Hitler's in power, they start to realize, some of them start to realize anyway, that they have miscalculated, that he is, as you say, a much more politically threatening guy who's heading towards a totalitarian regime, and he's eventually steering them towards a catastrophic war and genocide. And the more some of them start to realize this, the more there's a brave minority that becomes the core of the resistance movement. And that's a theme that really runs almost all the way through his time in power, that the core of the resistance tends to be some of these conservatives who have realized what a mistake they made.
Wasn't that the point of the Night of the Long Knives, this bloody purge of mid-1934? Wasn't that directed mainly against these right-wing opponents?
Yeah, that's a point I make in the book, which is not quite the normal view, because that's normally seen as being directed against some of Hitler's own more radical followers, the notorious brown shirts. But in fact, I think more evidence is coming out that shows that the brown shirts were sort of collateral damage in a move that was really aimed at people who were a bigger threat, these conservatives. And they were a bigger threat because they could potentially control the army, which, of course, ultimately is where power is going to come from. So Hitler has to worry about them a lot more.
My guest is Benjamin Carter Hett. He's the author of The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power. Ben, let's turn to some of the questions you yourself have raised. Was the problem with Germany in 1933 that it was not democratic enough, or was it too democratic?
Well, that's interesting. That's one of the things that historians have argued about for a long time. You know, historians bring their own worldview to the writing of history, and so there's been a tendency for conservative historians to think that the problem was too much democracy, and for liberal historians to think that there wasn't enough democracy. I would probably lean to thinking that the problem is more, especially after 1930, that what had been a viable democracy is getting killed systematically by moves by the conservative establishment to shut out the Reichstag. So in that sense, it's more a problem of not enough democracy.
You know, this has often been an issue for historians about whether Hitler's rise was inevitable. The distinguished British historian A.J.P. Taylor, and you quote him, his argument, and I think this is almost the conventional wisdom from that period, was that Hitler's rise was as inevitable and unsurprising as a river flowing from the sea. Indeed, the great British economist, John Maynard Keynes, writing in The Economic Consequences of the Peace, this is the Versailles Peace from 1919, in that book in the early 20s, Keynes predicted that the fierce reparations imposed on post-World War I Germany would spark, you know, a nationalist backlash in the form of fascism. But you disagree with that consensus view. You don't think that Hitler's rise was inevitable, do you?
No, I don't think at all it was inevitable. And in fact, nor was the collapse of German democracy inevitable. Those two things are slightly separate. You could have democracy collapsing without Hitler being the ultimate winner. But yeah, I think if you look at what was happening in the Weimar Republic in the middle of the 1920s, what you see is something that looks actually quite a lot like West Germany in the 1950s. You see a democracy starting to stabilize and settle, political support moving to the political center away from the extremes, the economy doing better and better, starting to surpass its 1913 levels of GDP and everything. So this was something that could have been a successful democracy had it not been essentially betrayed by some of the people in elite positions. So no, I don't hold with the idea that the peace treaty dooms it, or the view you quoted from A.J.P. Taylor that there's something fateful in the German character that dooms it. These are older views, but I don't think they hold up to some of the more recent research.
That's interesting. Okay, now you mentioned earlier in the interview about some analogies that might be drawn between the 1930s and today, especially in the United States. And some say that your book, The Death of Democracy, has real lessons for today about the elites who either assisted or were complacent as Hitler destroyed German democracy. A couple of your reviewers, Gerhard de Groot in the London Times, Yale historian Timothy Schneider, past guest on Between the Lines, he's writing in the New York Times, they say that your book provides a lesson about the fragility of democracy and the danger of that complacent belief that liberal institutions will always protect us. Do the 1930s really carry lessons for the US and indeed Europe today, Ben?
I really think they do, and I think that's one of them. One of the things I am worried about now in our time, in the United States and in other countries, is precisely that complacency. You know, in countries that have been democracies for a long time, I think many of us think, this system is settled and it's been around forever and the institution will protect us. But the thing is, the institution doesn't run by itself. The institution runs on human beings. And it is possible to imagine human beings conducting themselves in such a way that the basic premises of the system are violated and corrupted. And if citizens don't act aggressively to check that, then the thing will run along towards a bad outcome. I think that's in part what you see in the 1930s, but it's also in part something you see happening today in the United States, in Europe, around the world. You see this, I think, complacency about democratic stability is actually a real danger when you have people who do want to subvert the system.
I can certainly see how your argument applies to, say, Hungary, where Orbán has clearly centralized power and has turned Hungary's democracy into an illiberal state, as I think Orbán himself has boasted. But is it overstated to apply that to Trump in the United States? I mean, we've had nearly 2 years of the Donald in the White House. Surely it's clear that the US Constitution's normal checks and balances are working. I mean, just ask Judge Kavanaugh. I mean, you know, here's Trump's election meeting fierce resistance in the Senate. You've had scrutiny and accountability in Washington. That hasn't disappeared during the Trump era with all these investigations into Trump. So are we overstating the case here with respect to Trump?
Well, stay tuned on Kavanaugh. I'm very far from convinced that he won't get approved. I think there are some Republicans who are squeamish about some of the things that he has said and done, but whether they're sort of hand-wringing and, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, that's not very nice, will actually translate into them having the courage to vote against him, I am extremely skeptical. Because we have actually seen just about zero courage, especially from the Republican side of the aisle, in the last 2 years.
Yeah, and you're saying that this is in some respects similar to what the conservatives did with Hitler in the early years in 32, 33, 34.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. The book is called The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power. Ben, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Benjamin Carter Hett, he's professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York.